Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for joining us for October's Exotics Club webinar. I am delighted to welcome back to Webinar Club our speaker for today, lecturer at the Royal Dick School of Veterinary Studies based at the University of Edinburgh, Emma Keeble. Thank you, Emma. I'm now going to hand over to you.
Thank you very much, Emma. It's a pleasure to be speaking today and welcome to everyone who's joined the webinar. We have a lot to get through today and hopefully if you've got any questions, please do ask them as you go along and I'll try and answer them. The topic today is quite a wide topic. We're looking at small rodents, their general care and some common presenting conditions. And when I was doing the webinar, I was sort of thinking, what am I going to include? I think really we'll just look at the myomorphs, histricomorphs, and we'll leave the scuromorphs, which are the small chipmunks and so forth, because they're a little bit less common. But obviously, if you have any questions regarding those species, please do give me a shout. So I just wanted to go over what are myomorphs. These are the smaller rodents that we might encounter in practice, the rat, mouse, gerbil and hamster. And there are some other more obscure myomorphs that you also might come across in general practice. When we're talking about rodents, they are very different in terms of their anatomy, and the word rodent itself means to gnaw. And as I'm sure we're all aware, they've got these very sharp chisel-shaped incisors. With the smaller myomorphs, their dental formula is quite a little bit different to the histricomorphs, so they don't actually have any premolar teeth, and their front teeth, the incisors, are constantly growing, whereas the back teeth aren't. So it's these front teeth that they need to keep shaped by gnawing, and they need to be provided with things in their environment to do so. Just wanted to show you a little bit of a diagram just to sort of illustrate how important those front teeth really are, and that we've got this big gap and then these just three molar teeth at the back. So when they're actually gnawing, the lower jaw moves forward so that the incisors are actually in apposition, whereas when they're chewing, the molars are in apposition and the incisors aren't. So there's two different sort of motions really when these animals are eating. Other things that are of interest, I think, that we need to sort of bear in mind when we're examining them is, things like the fact that they have these separate openings. So in a female, you'll be able to see three different openings. And if you've got a discharge, particularly sort of female hamsters can get urethral discharges, vaginal discharges with pyometra. And you'll actually see where that discharge is coming from because they've got the separate openings, which is pretty cool. They have a very simple stomach, Sacculated cecum, and they do practice coprophagy like the lagomorphs. One thing that we often forget as well, I had a group of mice in just recently that were constantly breeding, is they do have a postpartum oestrus, so separating the male as soon as you know a female mouse is pregnant will prevent any further, hopefully, matings. Things like hamsters, we've got slightly different things with the cheek pouches, which can get very big and quite extensive, especially when they're full. And this can be confused with a mass or a problem by owners. In the male hamsters, they also have these very large flank glands, and these are normal. Quite often get owners pointing these out and saying, this is something that we think might be abnormal. And actually, as you can see on this picture, there's one there. And there's one there. These are totally normal. The other thing that I often get owners asking about is sort of male hamsters is the bulge that can come and go in this area. This is actually just the testicular area, and they are able to retract the testes, so they can look more pronounced at different times. So something just to point out to owners. And then in gerbils, we do midline abdomen have a ventral scent gland, and this is the picture over here. This is an abnormal scent gland. It's inflamed, but it lies on the midline on the underside of the gerbil, and it's a normal gland. It can get infected, and we'll talk about that in a wee bit. When we're looking at the histricomorphs, these are guinea pigs, chinchillas and degus. They are slightly different in their anatomy, and these animals do tend to get problems with dental disease quite commonly. As I mentioned, compared to the myomorphs, they have an extra premolar, and the back teeth are actually constantly growing, whereas with the myomorphs, they're not. And this is why they're a little bit more, I guess, like lagomorphs rabbits, in that they can develop dental disease quite quickly. They need the fibrostyle to sort of wear these teeth down. Again, they have a very large diastema. The mandible is actually wider than the maxilla. And when they're gnawing, the lower jaw is forward so that the incisors are opposed. So very similar to the myomorphs. But when they're chewing, it's the molars that are in apposition. And that's why it's really important to provide things for them to chew on so that they're wearing down the molar teeth, and we don't end up developing dental disease. I hope you can see this. This is just an example of a dentition chart that can be used to record any abnormal findings. And I would urge you to try and get hold of these in practice. They're really helpful, and you can note on them any spikes, any spurs, any loose teeth, any periodontal disease or pockets. So really helpful. And it's something that you can actually also show the owner as well. We're very lucky in that we've got a little video endoscope, so we can actually take video recordings of our work when we're doing dentals in these animals, and then show them back to the owner. But this is also another way of recording very accurately any problems. And also then you can review this chart when the animal comes back into you and at further dentals. Other anatomical points just with the hystricomorphs to note, very similar to myomorphs. They've got a simple stomach and they do have the cecum, and they're also coprophagic as well. We have the separate openings that we talked about with the myomorphs, and they also do have a postpartum oestrus. They do have less toes on the back legs in guinea pigs, and I do wonder if this slightly predisposes to pododermatitis. It's quite a common thing in guinea pigs to see, but we'll also talk about other things that could predispose that species to foot problems in just a short while. I just wanted to show you this. This is a male guinea pig, and these incredibly large structures are normal vesicular glands. So these are accessory sex glands that are normal in male guinea pigs. And when you're going to do abdominal surgery, it can be a little bit confusing when you open them up and see these. But that's a normal structure. With handling, I hope that we're all very happy with how we handle these animals. Rats in particular really hate to be scruffed, so I tend to avoid that. Obviously, it's quite good to find out from the owner first whether the animal is used to being handled or not, and it might give you an inkling whether it's likely to bite or whether it's actually very happy being handled by you. One way that I do it, so you can see the top picture here, is I like to place my thumb under the chin if I'm worried that the animal's going to bite. And that actually acts to stop it from reaching down and getting me. And they tolerate this very well, actually, rats, and they seem quite happy being held. I do think sometimes sort of minimal holding, if you can, for auscultation, for instance, just cupping around the animal can actually be less stressful and tolerated better. With mice, we do talk about holding them at the base of the tail, lifting them that way just briefly, and then placing them onto, for instance, the wire top of a cage. I don't tend to scruff mice. I don't think they particularly like it. Again, it can be difficult, but a lot of pet mice are very used to being handled. They can be very fast and they can jump, so making sure that you have them over a table where, you know, if they were to jump, they would land onto the table rather than the floor. That's really important. And again, I quite often use like a little cardboard tube just to sort of gently scoop the animal up and cover both ends, and you can actually then manipulate the tube so you can get the animal out and control it a little bit better that way. With hamsters, you do have to be very careful. If you're scruffing them, you can easily cause problems with the eyes. They tend to bulge and they can actually potentially prolapse. So again, I tend to use my thumb under the jaw like we showed with the rat, and they tolerate this very well. Or you can just cup them in your hands, a little bit like this pitch with the gerbil. If you know that the animal is unlikely to bite, then that can be a really good way to hold them. With gerbils, we have to to be careful, you can see in the picture there, we've actually got a degloving injury. And this is quite common. If you hold them by the tails, the skin will actually pull away and you end up left with the tail exposed and you have to amputate. So that's a little bit embarrassing if that happens. So you can, again, use your finger and and thumb around the head of the animal, like in the picture. And they seem to tolerate that really well. Moving on to clinical examination. One thing I find really useful is just watching the animal before you get anywhere near it. While you're chatting to the owner, just look at it at a distance, see what it's up to, in particular with breathing issues. And these little guys are very prone to respiratory diseases. You will pick up immediately whether that animal is dyspneic, whether you've got an increased effort and rate to the breathing pattern. Another thing that's very useful is recording weight on a regular basis, because we have a lot of elderly guinea pigs now. A little bit like rabbits, they're living a lot longer. And with that come old age issues such as osteoarthritis. And so checking weight on a regular basis, you know, for any trends, particularly downward trends, is absolutely key. It's also very common for rats to be quite overweight. So again, another reason why weight is very important. And then finally, if we're working out dose rates for such tiny animals, we need an accurate weight, because 10 grams could make quite a difference to a dose that you've calculated. I also do the classic work from head to tail, and I sort of teach students this as well. I try and get my vital parameters first before sort of any great hands-on, so in particular the respiratory rate. We try and get that before we actually examine the animal. Do all the auscultation parts first, so get your heart rate, get your respiratory rate. If you're feeling like you need to take a rectal temperature, do so. And then we'll do our head-to-tail examination. I have to admit, I often only really take rectal temperatures if I've got a very debilitated animal. And it's definitely worth doing if you've got a collapsed or weak or lethargic animal, or animal that's not been eating. But if I've got a very bright animal that is otherwise pretty well, I possibly wouldn't take a rectal temperature, because they do resent it, particularly rats. Guinea pigs and chinchillas less so, but certainly rats and the smaller animals, it can be quite difficult. And then we also must think about our examination of ears and also teeth, sort of at the very end of the examination. So I've got a chart here. You'll be able to find a lot of this information in any sort of small rodent textbooks, but quite useful to see what differences there are. Certainly getting a heart rate can be quite challenging in something like a mouse, where you might be up to 700 beats a minute. Respiratory rates as well can be very elevated. Something I think is interesting is their temperatures, certainly with mice, can be a little bit lower normally than you would perhaps expect for, say, a rabbit, where you're thinking 38.5 to 39.5. So worth noting that as well. Here we are weighing. This is a standard thing. As soon as the animal comes in, I tend to try and get a weight on it. Otherwise, I tend to forget. It's one of those things that you kick yourself afterwards for not having taken a weight. So it's something I do right at the start, and get the respiratory rate. And then I thought a couple of things that you might see very obviously on clinical exam. Here's a guinea pig with a head tilt. We'll come to sort of discuss why they might have a head tilt later on. But the main differential for this would be otitis media and interna potentially progressing to that. Another thing with guinea pigs going from head to tail, you might see this chelitis, which is a sort of inflammation around the commissures of the lips. And there's some thought as to what might cause this. It's something I've seen occasionally in guinea pigs. We mentioned dental disease, and I'm sure you're all very much aware of the sort of signs associated with this in rabbits, very similar in chinchillas and guinea pigs, and they get this excessive salivation in really extreme cases, particularly if there's spikes associated with the dental disease. And then in male guinea pigs, you quite often get sort of plugs around the back end, the perineum, around the urethra, or actually impacted around the anus as well. And that's just to show you something that's quite common. In chinchillas, in male chinchillas, furring, such as the picture shown here, is quite common as well. This is where they get an accumulation of fur at the very base of the penis, and it can cause a real constriction there. Often the penis is then extruded and becomes dry and necrotic. And these are treated medically. Usually, if you get them fairly early on, they don't require surgery. I mentioned about discharges in rodents from female animals. You can often tell exactly where the discharge is coming from depending on the actual hole and opening. In this one, we can see the urethra is here, then it's the vulva, and then we'll have the anus about here. So we know that this is a reproductive tract tissue. The far right picture is just showing you a chinchilla female. It's got a bit of a discharge, but we couldn't really tell from that picture where it's from. I also mentioned pododermatitis. It's really common, particularly guinea pigs. You can see it also in chinchillas, so always have a look at the hocks. This is a picture just showing a slightly inflamed hock, and we might be needing to look at husbandry for this or other predisposing causes. Perhaps this animal's got arthritis and it's not able to ambulate well, and it's sitting, it's quite sedentary. So worth thinking about other reasons why you might be seeing this. So that was a sort of brief overview of a little bit of anatomy, a little bit of clinical examinations. And now I thought I'd move on for the rest of the webinar to look at common diseases. And I've divided these into sort of body systems, hopefully so that we can sort of categorize them better. I've also looking initially at myomorphs and then coming on to look at guinea pigs and chinchillas and their common problems within those categories of body systems. So the main skin diseases that we might see in myomorphs are associated with parasitic infections. They are relatively common. The fermites are the most likely cause, and these can be hypersensitivities rather than real sort of infections. It always really impresses owners if you can learn the names of the fermites, and they've got some quite cool names. You can see them listed there. You can very easily see these on microscopy and see the egg that's there. And I think they can be incredibly debilitating for animals. You can see in the pictures how much the skin is damaged and excoriated. Another parasitic disease that you might see in rats, although I haven't seen this for a wee while, is Notoeges, and it's very classical. You see these nodules right at the tips of the ears, can also affect the tail, and you can see the little dots on the tail as well. You can take biopsies. They're really difficult to get on skin scrape, but deep biopsies, you'll see the mites. But usually you don't need to do that because it's quite a classical presentation. In hamsters, we get two types of Demodex. Again, owners love it if you can tell them the different types. So Cracchetti are short and fat, and a Rauti, as in the picture, are long and slender. And often in hamsters, Demodex infections are secondary to poor immune system and stress. So if you see fur loss and you find Demodex, usually there's something else going on, and you need to let the owner know about that. So how are we going to treat these? Well, they generally all respond to ivermectin, and this can be either given by injection, or it can be topically placed, or it can be given orally as well. And I tend to repeat these doses every sort of 7 to 10 days, usually for 3 treatments. This is a case of Notoedres in a hamster. Again, it's quite rare. I haven't seen this for a while, but when you see it, it's very obvious it's affecting the ears primarily. We've mentioned pododermatitis in the larger hystrichomorphs, but you can also see these in rats and mice, quite commonly in aged rats that are perhaps overweight, perhaps they're heavier in that they might have a mammary tumour. It's quite common to see this, so always check the underside of the feet, and if need be, we need to be providing softer sort of substrates and beddings, and in extreme cases, you might need to dress them and place bandages as well. In gerbils, they classically talk about facial dermatitis. This is a inflammation around the nose, often associated with either digging substrates or possible with nasal secretions that encrust around the nares. Something, again, that I haven't seen for a little while, and it's usually associated with husbandry. We are also likely to see abscesses. These are common, particularly in rats that have been fighting. Male rats often, once they get to sort of reach sexual maturity, they can suddenly turn on each other and fight. And abscesses are relatively common. These are treated just as you would in any other mammal. We also need to bear in mind, if you've got an area of alopecia, particularly a sort of circular area with crusting, that we could have fungal disease. And actually recently in our handling unit, we've had an outbreak of, fungal skin infection in our guinea pigs. So something that you potentially would encounter. Animals can be carriers and relatively asymptomatic, so it can be difficult. But if you're seeing lesions like the one in the picture, you need to be sampling these and culturing them and warning owners start wearing gloves. It is difficult to treat, but there are many different washes that we can use or oral preparations as well. And we also have to look at the environment and decontaminating that. Once it's cleared, then routine screening as well is recommended, really to prevent it recurring, because it's quite a common thing once it's in a collection. I wanted at this stage, I will come on to talk about endocrine disease, but just to mention it in hamsters, we were talking about Demodex and hair loss in hamsters, but there are other reasons why you might see hair loss. Cushing's disease is something that has been described, and we do, I feel, see this relatively commonly in older hamsters. Quite often you just get the areas of alopecia, but you might also see that the animal's got increased thirst, increased urination, and maybe increased appetite as well. Having said that, renal disease is also quite common in older hamsters, so increased thirst could have other causes. It is something that we can diagnose. We can look at our history, our clinical exam. There are some blood parameters that we can look at as well. We are very lucky at the vet school in that we have an amazing ultrasound machine and also imaging department, and they are able to visualize and look at adrenal glands in hamsters on ultrasound exam. But if you haven't got that luxury, then you might want to offer an owner skin biopsies. There are case reports described where surgical removal of the affected gland has been attempted. Obviously, that would be quite hairy surgery, but something that we could certainly offer owners. But there are also treatments listed there that we could try as well. Success has been varied, and certainly in the literature, some have responded and some haven't, and it can be difficult to titrate doses as well. I also wanted to mention neoplastic skin diseases, certainly very common in older male gerbils, is to see sebaceous gland adenomas or adenocarcinomas, and you can't easily tell which it is just by looking at it. So usually the best thing is to remove these, and they do fine without their scent gland, and then send for histology and see what type you've got. They can get very ulcerated and bleeding and secondary infected as well. In hamsters, we do get a whole series of different neoplasms. The epithelial trophic lymphoma is relatively common, but they can also get melanomas as well. We also can see pox virus lesions. So, you know, it's worth just bearing in mind as they get older, they are more prone to these conditions. And obviously, they're going likely to be uncomfortable, painful, and probably euthanasia is the way to go with these small animals in these cases. And then we're all probably very much aware of the mammary masses that we will see in both male and female rats, also in mice as well. Very common. Quite often these are fibroadenomas, but there is a small percentage that are adenocarcinomas. So it is worth offering an owner, you know, histopathology to confirm. The problem in rats is we really can't do mammary strips because their mammary tissue is so extensive. So always warn owners that they're likely, once they've had one, to pop up mammary tumours in other glands as well. And we actually have a little chart. It's a rough sort of diagram of where the mammary tissue is in the rat, and we mark on that where we've removed the mass from. We've had a couple of cases where owners have then said, you haven't removed the mass, we've got a, you know, the mass is there still, and actually it's a new mass that's come up within the week since we've last seen the animal. So it's worth noting on a chart or noting in your records exactly where the mass is and what size it is. And certainly if they're coming in for surgery, you need to be thinking about definitely confirming with the owner that you're on the same page in terms of where the mass is, because you may well have multiple ones at the same time. They can get very ulcerated and bleed as well, and obviously then that can cause pain and problems with that. In mice, the mammary masses tend to be malignant and nasty. So, moving on to guinea pigs and chinchillas and skin disease, Calotiella is quite a common thing in guinea pigs. It's also seen, obviously, in rabbits. Very similar clinical signs with the dry, sort of scurfy skin, and these are diagnosed usually on impressions or tape strips or hair plucks, and you'll see the parasite. They respond very well to ivermectin, and there are topical preparations that you can use. I mentioned ringworm in guinea pigs as well, and this can actually, I think, perhaps be more common than we think. You can get secondary bacterial skin diseases, and particularly if you've got a dermatitis secondary to excessive salivation, we've got dental disease causing that, then, you know, we need to be also thinking about how we treat the skin, whether we're going to clip all that area that's wet and try and start treating a secondary dermatitis. And then I also mentioned the colitis that we see sometimes at the commissures or guinea pigs' mouths. There's some thoughts as to what causes this, and I've listed them actually in that slide. Some people have isolated pox virus particles on histo in these lesions, so it could well have been an infection, and then all these secondary bacterial invaders come in. But also there's some thought that hypervitaminosis C might contribute, so it's worth supplementing these animals as well with vitamin C. And then another common thing in guinea pigs is hormonal alopecia, and we'll come on to discuss that under endocrine disease. So this is just showing you the colitis. This is an animal that had pretty severe, it was affected along the sort of philtrum and then also at the commissures, although in the second photo it's now healing and this is looking a little bit better in this area here. Treatment is with sort of topical cleaning, you can use creams, you can use systemic antibiotics, and if need be, you know, analgesia as well. Another thing in guinea pigs, it's very common, are these trichofolliculomas. Again, owners quite like, you know, when you diagnose, we think it's a trichofollicular, they love the name of it. They tend to be very benign, very commonly found, particularly around the sort of dorsum and the back end. They can get quite big and they can ulcerate and they produce a sort of caseous material from the center. And I'm sure you've seen these in practice. Expressing really doesn't work because you leave the capsule intact and they reform. So the best thing to do with these actually is to remove them. They do often get infected and they can be painful. So although it's an anesthetic, it's hopefully fairly straightforward and removing them is the best option. In chinchillas, it's quite rare to get skin disease, actually. You can get facial dermatitis secondary to dental pathology. They often talk about fur slip in chinchillas, and you will get small amounts of fur coming away, but this was a big thing when chinchillas were used mainly in farming for their pelts. And it's not really such an issue, I think, in practice. And most of our pet chinchillas are very used to being handled and tend not to sort of leave large clumps of fur when you're handling them. But ectoparasites are very rare because they've got such dense fur pelts, and you know, they're basically adapted to living in very cold climates up in the Andes. So it is very unlikely that you will see parasites, although Calotheella has been reported. I mentioned earlier about the furring in males. So when you're doing a clinical exam, if it's a male animal, always have a look around the base of the penis. Sometimes this does mean extruding, but usually if you've got a fur ring, the penis already will be extruded and inflamed. So if you see this, then you might need to sedate the animal or even anaesthetize it because it's so painful. And then the material needs to be removed. And usually if you lubricate, you can replace, you know, the penis back. This is just to show you, this is in a guinea pig. You can also get necrosis of the penis and the prepuce in male guinea pigs, particularly if they've been breeding with sows, or sometimes they get accumulation of material. I think I'd shown you a picture earlier. It just accumulates and can actually cause trauma and inflammation around the area as well. So very painful, and you might need to use systemic antibiotics, but certainly analgesics and lubrication. So we've covered skin disease. I want to move on to gastrointestinal disease, which really with the myomorphs and histricomorphs is slightly different. Myomorphs, they tend to get infectious causes, whereas histricomorphs, we tend to see a little bit more like rabbits, that they get motility issues, and these are often associated with dental disease. So in the small myomorphs, the types of things that we might see usually are bacterial overgrowths, and these are often in young animals that are perhaps overcrowded, perhaps have been mixed with different groups, quite common in pet shops in particular, or if you've got a young animal that's undergone a lot of stress and has recently been acquired from a pet shop as well. Tends to cause really severe lethargy, diarrhea. Usually animals will die, and it can progress and cause neurological signs as well. With Clostridia, the types of antibiotics we want to think about are tetracyclines in particular. But we also need to address underlying problems with husbandry and hygiene. And perhaps, you know, practices, if it's a pet shop, we need to be perhaps isolating and quarantining animals. Another thing that we will see, a different type of infection but similar clinical signs, is wet tail in young hamsters. And this is again associated with diarrhea, weight loss, lethargy, collapse, you know, going into shock as well. Treatment is pretty much the same, so probably tetracyclines are the drug to use in both these cases. And if we're not sure, we haven't had a post-mortem diagnosis with histopathology and culture, then maybe we just go for tetracyclines in these small animals. As I mentioned with the histricomorphs, it's more common to see ileus. And this is very similar to our rabbit patients. So it can be associated with stress, anaesthetic, surgery, any disease process, but also husbandry, diet. You know, we could have this occurring. I literally had a chinchilla in last week as a referral, and it was being fed absolutely no hay. It just had a muesli mix it was fed on, and sort of these seeds, sort of sweet sticks that they can gnaw on. So, you know, there still is a degree of ignorance in owners out there, and it really is important for us to go through their husbandry and diet at the first consult, so we figure out what they are actually feeding these animals. And as you can see, hay is really important in their diet. So all our supportive care is very similar as to what we would perhaps use in our rabbit patients who want to be thinking about good fluid support, about addressing any hypothermia and collapse. We might also have low blood glucose, so we routinely would check that as well in these small patients. Nutritional support, very important. And then prokinetic drugs, if we're happy we haven't got a blockage, we would start things like ranitidine, cisapride, metoclopramide, and really quite intensive treatment, and very quickly they will respond if we can get in there quite early. Obviously the picture in that radiograph you can see is pretty serious. We've got quite a cecal tympani there and a little bit of gas in the stomach as well. So it's quite important to be very intensive with these cases. We do sometimes in severe cases also start to see fitting with hypoglycemia. So that might not necessarily be a primary neurological problem. It could be, you know, systemic effects of collapse and shock. I thought I would just spend a little bit of time on dental disease under the gastrointestinal sort of umbrella, particularly in histricomorphs, and it is very similar to rabbits, so hopefully you're all very happy with how you treat these cases. I think we can really extrapolate from our rabbit patients. The only thing I find really difficult, I think, with guinea pigs and chinchillas is the visualization of the dental arcades. And interestingly, both chinchillas and guinea pigs will relatively well tolerate these little tiny cheek pouch dilators that you can see in the picture there. And they'll tolerate those contours, so I tend not to put anything else on but just the little cheek pouch dilators, and you can get a bit of a better look. Now, I might ask owners if I can do this and then take the animal through to the back, you know, and do it with a nurse holding, because some owners can get a little bit upset with it. But if it's very brief and it gives you a chance to see a spike, then it's really, really useful. Obviously, if you're then suspicious, you'd need to sedate and do general anesthesia so that you can actually get a proper look at the teeth. Thought I'd show some pictures. When you're looking at chinchilla incisors, if they're very square-ended, like in the picture here, that immediately rings alarm bells with me that there is some dental pathology ongoing. And quite often what we've got are the cheek tooth being overgrown and forcing the jaw apart so that then the incisors are not in apposition and wearing properly. So usually the incisors are secondary to cheek teeth issues. We've got a little tabletop setup that we can use. Nowadays, we actually, if possible, certainly with our rabbits, we intubate and maintain, you know, on gaseous anesthesia. With chinchillas and guinea pigs, if we can't intubate, we put nasal oxygen on so that they're well oxygenated during the procedure. And obviously, you need illumination and you need as much good visualization as possible. As I mentioned earlier, we've got a little video endoscope, so this is really helpful. If you can persuade your practice to invest in one of these, it really makes your life a lot easier, and you can actually show other people and video and record images for your clients. So just showing you all the dental equipment that's out. We've got the endoscope there as well to show and record what we're doing. And it can be a tiny, tiny area that you're working in, and that can be very difficult. It's very, very easy to miss spikes right at the back that are deeply embedded. So using a little spatula, we've got a little metal one that we try and prise away the teeth right at the back so we can see how they're affecting the gum, and try also prevent any soft tissue damage from the burr. It's something that you just have to get used to, I guess, and practice on, and it is really tricky. You're not working in an area that's a lot of space. Just further images as well to show you. So I want to move on from dental disease to respiratory disease, and this is a really, really common thing in rats and mice, and actually also in guinea pigs as well. We do see this too. You're probably all very much aware of it in rat patients, and owners will report that they're hearing sort of wheezes and rattles. Sometimes you can even just hold the animal up to your ear and you'll hear it's breathing. Often this is upper respiratory noise, but we also do get a lot of lower respiratory tract infections as well. And in really severe cases, they can be very debilitated. Because they're unable to mouth breathe, this is why I think, you know, animals can very quickly go downhill with respiratory infections. And often this can also progress to head tilts and otitis media interna, and it's really common in guinea pigs, but also in rats as well. The type of infections, I've got a list here of the different infectious agents that might be involved. There are quite a few. Viral disease tends to be pretty rare, but has been reported certainly in the small myomorphs. We all know that we probably shouldn't mix guinea pigs with rabbits, because rabbits can be carriers and asymptomatic for Bordetella and then obviously infect guinea pigs. So just being aware of that is really, really important. I'd probably say the most common respiratory pathogen in rats and mice is mycoplasma. And once they've got mycoplasma, they tend to be carriers for life. How are we going to diagnose this? Well, we've obviously got really obvious clinical signs, but we might want to consider offering owners other further diagnostic tests. So radiography, we have done tracheal washes even in little tiny rats and culture those, and also do cytology. We've now got CT, which is a wonderful tool and really good for looking at respiratory tracts and airways in small animals. Usually we would have to sedate. We don't sedate our rabbits. I think we'd probably get away without sedating guinea pigs, but chinchillas and the smaller myomorphs we probably would have to sedate or even anaesthetize to get a good CT image. So how are we going to treat these cases? Well, in really dyspneic animals, oxygen immediately is absolutely paramount. And trying to get pulse ox readings in these small animals can be very difficult, and it depends on the accuracy of your equipment. But that can be helpful to determine how severely compromised they are. We use a lot of nebulization, and owners very quickly get used to this and can actually purchase their own nebulizers relatively cheaply online, and do this at home. And we can actually nebulize a lot of different types of treatments to help. The things I like in particular are the mucolytics and the bronchodilators. So I'll perhaps use salbutamol or terbutaline. And acetylcysteine is another one that's a mucolytic that we could use, or bromhexine as well. So lots of different things we can do. We can go for oral treatments as well, and we certainly want to be thinking about antibacterials, and I've listed some of the antibacterial drugs that we might use. Quite often we'll start these animals on enrofloxacin because they will be effective hopefully in rats and mice against some mycoplasmas, but we might also want to then add in doxycycline as well. I think it's always worth thinking about ammonia and dust in the environment. It's going to exacerbate any animal that's got respiratory disease. So, you know, reducing that, and there are things that owners can do to help with the husbandry, and they quite like this. So have a chat about generally reducing sort of stress, the respiratory system from the environment. I would add on that slide as well, non-steroidal anti-inflammatories. I use these a lot, and meloxicam is the main one. It's a much, much higher dose, just once a day in small rodents, the myomorphs, so 1 to 2 mg/kg per os once a day. In guinea pigs, we use the same as rabbits, so it's 0.6 mg/kg twice daily by mouth. So, you know, slightly higher than you would in dogs and cats. But I think that really helps as well. Worth just mentioning cardiac disease. I'm not going to spend much time on it, but certainly older guinea pigs, dilated cardiomyopathy has been described. And, you know, if you've got a dyspneic animal, is it actually, you know, the airways, or is this actually something to do with the heart? So worth just having that in the back of your mind, and do we need to do a workup for that? So I'm now moving on to endocrine disease. It's a big area, actually, interestingly, in the myomorphs and hystricomorphs, and we do see this quite a lot. I'm sure you're all very much aware of diabetes in hamsters. Certain lines of hamsters actually have spontaneous diabetes showing really early on in their lives. So it is something that's quite common, particularly in the little dwarf hamsters. The sort of things owners might notice are increased thirst in particular, I think. They might get secondary cystitis, they might perhaps urinate more frequently as well, and they might start losing a little bit of weight. We can do some minimal tests to try and determine what's going on. It's very hard though because hypoglycemia can occur with handling and stress anyhow. But the one thing that I try and do initially is get a urinary dipstick and check for evidence of glycosuria, and that's relatively straightforward to do. We'd also perhaps get the animal in and record how much it's drinking in 24 hours as well. Things that we could do to try and treat this, it's difficult, but dietary restrictions are the main thing, and I think they can help quite a bit. But you can, I have tried treating with insulin as well, but it's very hard getting them stabilized, and they can be very difficult. But I would get an animal admitted to do this and keep it in under your care while you're trying to figure out a regime for it. It's also been diagnosed in guinea pigs and chinchillas, fairly similar clinical signs, but in guinea pigs you often get early onset cataracts as well. It can manifest in guinea pigs as cystitis, and so should be on your differential for any cystitis or any animal presenting with aberrant urination. We can take blood and do some sort of perhaps more in-depth tests in guinea pigs and chinchillas. I do find you can get a very small amount for blood glucose just from the ear veins, and we use a little bit of Emla cream. It's a local anesthetic cream on the ears. Leave it for 15 minutes, and then afterwards we just put a little needle prick and get our glucose test from that. And if we've got these animals in and we're trying to do glucose curves, it's a really useful way to do it. Increasing the fiber in the diet can be a massive beneficial thing to do in these animals, but also there are described routines for using insulin as well. And again, I would get them in to stabilize them whilst in your care. Hypothyroidism in hamsters has very similar sort of clinical signs, really, I guess, to Cushing's in hamsters. You get the alopecia, but you also get this sort of hyperpigmentation and slightly thickened looking skin. So perhaps slightly different to the Cushing's. Treatment is with thyroxine, and obviously, again, trying to get dose rates and titrate these can be difficult. Often you get concurrent other diseases as well, so whether owners would want to go for treatment or not is a discussion to have. Cystic ovarian disease is a really common condition in pet guinea pigs, and as they're living a little bit older, we do see it a lot. I've got a figure there of 76% in animals over the age of 1.5 to 5 years. It can be relatively asymptomatic, so we often get these animals coming in, you do your routine clinical exam, and then you feel this really enlarged ovaries. Often you think, is that the kidney or is that the ovary? And the ovaries feel much more irregular when you're palpating them. And then if you palpate this sort of irregular structure and then move more cranially, you should be able to feel the kidney feeling a lot smoother in the abdomen. Sometimes you'll get symmetrical alopecia. It really depends on the type of cyst that's involved. And you can get mixed cysts as well that will produce different clinical signs. And they can be really massive. You can see this picture here, it's at post-mortem. We've got enormous cystic ovaries, one on each side, just filling the abdomen. It must be really quite uncomfortable for these animals. And you can get secondary issues with gut stasis and bloat as well. So you might see these changes around the vulval area, you might see this sort of areas of hair loss as well, and quite a distended looking abdomen. Very easy to diagnose. You can usually palpate them, but I quite often like to also ultrasound examine them as well, because we can get an idea of the size, we can also get an idea of the type of cyst, and we can also look at the reproductive tract and see if there's anything abnormal. You can get neoplasia of the reproductive tract concurrently with this type of problem. So I think do offer your clients an ultrasound scan to sort of determine further what's going on, and then we can offer different options for treatment. One option that we could offer is human chorionic gonadotropin injections, and these are given weekly for 3 injections. I've had very variable success with that. In fact, you know, not really good success, and it depends on the type of cyst as to whether they're going to respond. Another option is to use ultrasound-guided percutaneous drainage, but they can recur and refill, so it's only temporary, and this might be in an aged animal where you're wanting to really avoid any surgery. There has been some more recent work done with desmorelin implants, and if these are ones that are responsive to hormonal therapies, then it's worth trialing that and seeing. They're more likely to respond if you've got the hair loss as well. But really, probably the only way to sort these is to do ovariohysterectomy. And I do find in guinea pigs that it's much harder than in rabbits, because they have such short ovarian ligaments and the ovaries can be very deep within the body. Usually you do have to locate and drain the cysts so that you can actually work around them and get as much material out as possible. But it's worth warning owners that this is a big operation and adhesions are possible and regrowth is possible if you don't get the whole of the ovary removed in the one time. So worth talking through cases and not downplaying, how big an operation it is for that animal. Guinea pigs can be pretty, they need quite intensive nursing care post any surgery or anaesthetic, and they just sometimes seem to give up in my experience. And so it is really important to emphasise to owners that this is quite a big operation and there is going to be needed quite a bit of supportive care surrounding the post-op period. Cushing's disease has been reported in guinea pigs. We've already discussed it under skin disease in hamsters, but clinical signs tend to be fairly similar with the same alopecia. You might have increased thirst and weight loss as well. And there are tests that have been done to look at this and treatment options that have been reported as well. So it's worth bearing in mind if you're seeing this sort of pattern of hair loss, most likely to be ovarian disease, but also Cushing's should be at the back of your mind. And then moving on to neurological disease, I just got this one slide really because it's something that in older aged rats I do see quite commonly, and it's something that can be quite subtle from the start. Chronic progressive radiculomyopathy is a progressive disease of older animals that causes degeneration of the myelin around the spinal nerves, and it manifests as mild paresis in the first instance, but does progress to quite severe paresis and paralysis in the sort of end stages, quite often affecting the hind limbs initially, and then it can progress to affect the forelimbs as well. And really there's no treatment, just supportive care. I have a video I just want to play for you while we're talking about this disease that hopefully you can see. This animal actually is quite severely affected, but you can appreciate as it's trying to place its hind limbs, it's slightly slow in placement and occasionally actually sort of dragging the limbs. It's also doing a lot of pivoting, so it's not able to sort of move freely. It's about to jump across to the table and you'll see that it can't actually place its hind limbs properly on the table as it does so. You see it's just slipped down there and then it's managed to bring the leg up. So something when you're getting animals in just for your routine health checks or for respiratory disease problems, let them walk across the table, see if there's any early onset signs, because if you pick this up earlier, then owners will be aware of it and be able to manage the animal. They can get around okay with it, but they might have to remove climbing things and you know, things that they could fall off if they slip. There's no real treatment, but when it progresses to affect the forelimbs as well, we might have to give critical care diets so that the animal can eat more easily. And obviously, as it advances, if it's causing major problems, we need to consider euthanasia, you know, towards the end. So just something to mention, you will see it a lot in older rats, you know, over a year and a half of age. Another thing I really want to highlight as really key, I know we're sort of getting to the end of our talk just now, but this is an absolutely crucial thing that I really strongly feel we are underdiagnosing in practice. It's arthritis in guinea pigs. And I did a study really recently that I presented just this year in Venice at a conference. We looked at all the radiographs that we had over a two-year period. And these were animals, we excluded animals that were being radiographed for musculoskeletal disease. So these were just incidental radiographs, usually for ileus or gut stasis. And we assessed presence of osteoarthritis. And we found we had 100% incidence in the radiographs that we looked at. So to me, this is, you know, really, really common. Quite often what we're seeing in the animal is a reduced range of movement, and I find that the hocks in particular and the stifles, they can't fully extend. And because of this, we get secondary pododermatitis. And now here, I finally got back to why a guinea pig might also have pododermatitis. It could be it's got arthritis. And I'm seeing these in really young animals, you know, 2 years onwards, very, very common. How are we going to treat them? Well, obviously long-term analgesia, we might want to reduce the weight of the animal. We might think about husbandry changes. If the animal's having to sort of reach up and stand on its hind legs to get a hay rack, for instance, we might want to move that down so it doesn't have to do that. And there's actually a lot of literature out there using guinea pigs as spontaneous models for osteoarthritis in people, and a lot of work looking at omega-3 fatty acid supplementation. So perhaps this is something that we could consider offering our clients as a sort of preventative if we're catching this at an early age. So do have a look on your radiographs. If you've taken a picture, you know, for other causes such as ileus, just look at the stifles in particular and the hocks, and you may well start to see a lot of osteoarthritis. In terms of analgesia, if we're looking at long-term use, we might not want to use meloxicam in an aged animal with possible renal issues, but meloxicam certainly is one analgesic that we could use. I've also started using tramadol quite a lot in guinea pigs, particularly ones that perhaps have renal disease, and I use it at 5 mg/kg per os twice a day, and we have a solution in drops that's readily available that is really useful for these little animals. So that's something, please do sort of go away from this webinar, and if it's one thing that you take from it, start looking at your radiographs of guinea pigs, and you will find that you're seeing a lot of osteoarthritis. So just really to sort of finish up, we've got a couple more slides just to cover. Again, another condition that often is in aged animals is renal disease. And I would add in not just rats, but guinea pigs very commonly have this too. What might we see? Well, just fairly non-specific weight loss, but we could also see secondary problems with cystitis, increased thirst and increased urination. We want to be looking at biochemistry and urinalysis, and we also do ultrasound scan a lot of our cases, and you can actually see perhaps physical changes within the kidneys. This could also be related to calculi as well, so you know it's really good to ultrasound scan because you would hopefully rule out other causes of renal disease. We might want to consider good supportive care, enteric sort of support with high nutritional convalescent type diets, intensive fluid therapy, and we might consider anabolic steroids if, you know, if we've got weight loss as well. We want to consider avoiding stress where possible and perhaps a low protein diet. Something you will also see, as I mentioned, in guinea pigs. Another common thing that I see in guinea pigs is leukemia, and this can present with generalized lymphadenopathy. So any guinea pig that's coming in, please do remember to feel its lymph nodes. Obviously, in very advanced cases, the lymph nodes can be enormous, and you can actually appreciate, I think this is sort of the circumference of the submandibular lymph node in this animal. It was absolutely enormous. And unfortunately, owner hadn't actually noticed this, which is unusual. You also tend to get general sort of weight loss, rough hair coat. There might be a reduction in appetite as well. It tends to be a fairly rapid disease course, and by the time you're seeing lymphadenopathy, such as this case, you know, it can be pretty end stage. But chemotherapy is possible. There are regimens that have been described, and as a sort of minimal, you could try prednisolone at immunosuppressive doses. There has been, it has been indicated this could be, it is an infectious cause in guinea pigs, so you might see it in groups of guinea pigs related to retroviral infections. So if an owner brings in one and has others at home, it might be worth getting the others in to have a look and see whether you've got any obvious enlarged lymph nodes. And I mentioned cystitis and calculi a little bit with the slide on renal disease, but it is really common in guinea pigs. Obviously, we see it in other species, but certainly guinea pigs seem very prone. Animals that are showing signs of what we think might be cystitis could be also secondary cystitis to calculus, and these can occur in the kidneys, the ureters, bladder, urethra. The radiograph, you can see at the top there, you've got a urethral stone right at the distal point. I'll just get the arrow and point to, you can just see there. So palpating the animal in that area on clinical exam is really important. And you might then be able to actually see that we've got a stone just at the very distal part of the urethra in this guinea pig. What do we do about them? Well, usually they do need physical removal. So if we're looking at bladder stones, then we need to do cystotomies. We need to think about secondary infections, increased vitamin C, maybe some glucosamine as well. Dietary changes might be possible, but I think the main thing is increasing fluid intake in these animals and trying to get them to drink more and to flush through the system because, you know, they do commonly recur. And if they've had them once, then you ought to have that animal back to screen it fairly regularly, perhaps with radiography, and determine whether there's anything recurring. I have had cases where both of the ureters have been blocked, partly blocked, and the guinea pig's still alive and coping, but in intense pain. So, you know, ultrasound scan is really key to diagnosing these in small guinea pigs. So it's been quite a run through. Thank you so much for joining us today. I hope that you've found this useful and have learnt some things from, you know, the general discussion. If you've got any questions, do please get back to me. But I think that's us finished for today. And I just want to show you this last little picture. This is one of my much loved small mouse patients that owner decided to design hats for. So owners do get very attached to their small rodent pets, and offering a high standard of veterinary care is really key. Thank you very much for joining me today.
On behalf of Webinar Club, I'd like to thank Emma for a great presentation today. The recording and the certificate for this webinar will be available in the next few days in the members area of Webinar Club. Thank you all for attending. That's the end of the webinar.